be in Genesis 12 this morning. For those of you who have not been with us, I'll kind of give you a real quick overview of what we're looking at this morning. What we've been doing is we've asked the question, basically, what is the big picture of the Bible? Because sometimes people hear sermons on heaven, they hear sermons on hell, they hear sermons on marriage, they hear sermons on money, they hear sermons on politics, everything known to man, and sometimes we end up having little puzzle pieces and never seeing the big picture. We hear of Jesus, we hear of Samson, we hear of David, we hear of, you know, the flood, and we kind of go, how on earth does all this fit together? So what we've done is we've decided we're going to just zoom way back, start at the very beginning, and we're going to go through each puzzle piece, and we're going to show how each puzzle piece fits into the big picture, which is the Word of God, which is what God is doing. And what we've seen is that God created mankind to give him glory, or to show how great and awesome God is, how good he is, how kind he is, how creative he is, how just he is, how holy he is, how perfect he is, how glorious he is. We looked and saw that mankind sinned, and that the fellowship they had with God was broken, that they chose, instead of giving him glory, they chose to live for self. And we look because of that, that a curse was placed upon mankind, that sin and death, pain and suffering entered this world, but that a promise was given, and that that was the seed, remember that word, the seed of the woman, that there is going to come a descendant from Eve. It's not going to be from Adam, it's going to be from Eve, because this is going to be what the Bible calls the second Adam, someone who is born of a virgin, who does not have Adam's nature, but has the nature of Eve. So it's going to be someone who has a divine nature, that's the deity. It's going to have a human nature, that's the nature of Eve. So we're looking for a divine human deliverer, and it's the promise that he's going to crush the head of the snake and restore mankind. So we looked from there, and we saw how it wasn't the line of Cain, but it was going to be through the line of Seth. We looked at how the line of Seth intermarried with the line of Cain, which brought about sin, which brought about the flood, and we looked at Noah. And we looked at Noah and the deliverance that was brought through Noah, but how Noah was not the deliverer we're looking for. But then we saw Noah's failure, and then we saw the curse placed upon Canaan. So now the question comes after the Tower of Babel, which we looked at last week, is where is the deliverer going to come from? Who is the seed of the woman? Where is the seed of the woman? How is this disaster that has been with death and pain and suffering and the flood and murder and drunkenness and all of the sin that we've already looked at so far, how are we ever going to escape this? We are looking now for the seed, singular. We're looking for the one. We're looking for what the Bible would call the Messiah, the anointed one, the Christ. So with that in mind, we're going to now come and encounter a man named Abram. So in Genesis 12, we're going to look here at Abram, beginning in verse 1. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house, unto a land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless them that bless you, and curse him that curses you. And notice this last part. And in you shall all families of the earth be blessed. God comes to Abram and says, leave. Leave your homeland. Leave your people. I'm going to show you a place, and I'm going to make of you a blessing. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So what we begin to see here is when God calls Abram, one of the things that God calls Abram to do is to be a blessing to the whole earth. Now, Abram is one man. How can one man bring about a blessing to all of mankind that is under a curse? This right here is showing that the seed, the Messiah, is going to come from Abraham. That from Abraham is going to come the blessing that is going to affect all the families of the earth. In other words, we're going to see at the end of the Bible in Revelation, we find that people from every family are saved, every tribe, tongue, nation, are saved and are before the throne of God. How does that come about? Well, it's going to come about through the Messiah, the Christ, the deliverer. Where is he going to come from? The line of Canaan? No. The line of Lot? No. The line of Ham? No. The line of Japheth? No. It's going to come from Abram. So the whole of the Bible here takes all of mankind and now zooms in, and all of our focus from here on is going to be Abraham. We're going to go from Abram. And then we're going to ask this question, is it going to be Ishmael or is it going to be Isaac?
And the answer is going to be Isaac. And the question is going to be, well, okay, Isaac, is it going to be Jacob or is it going to be Esau? And it's going to be Jacob. And you go from there, and then Jacob's got 12 kids. Is it going to be Reuben? No. Simeon? No. Levi? No. Judah! Oh, but Judah's got a messed up family. And we're going to see. The focus keeps going narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower. So now, because all of mankind, after the flood, now our focus is on Abram. So the reason from here on that the Bible is concerned with the Jews, the descendants of Abraham, is because all of mankind's hope rests in the descendant that comes from Abraham. That's the focus here. The focus of the Old Testament is not the nation of Israel. The focus of the Old Testament is the one who's going to come out of the nation of Israel. And that is the one who's going to bring about a blessing for all of mankind. That is the Christ. That is the Messiah. That is the Savior. So through this, that's what we're going to be focusing on now. So we're going to go from Abraham, we're going to go to Isaac, we're going to go to Jacob, then we're going to go to Judah, and we're going to keep going all the way through the Old Testament to see how all of these stories, all of them, in Exodus and how the law of Leviticus, how this all fits in the big picture. If you remember last Sunday morning, we read in John 5, what did Jesus tell the Pharisees? Go back and read the Bible. Why? He said, because it's about me. So what we're looking here is not about Abraham, we're looking at the Messiah. Because that's the one who's going to bring out the blessing upon all of mankind. So let's skip on through this. This is Abraham goes down to Egypt. He's down to Egypt. He comes back. He meets with Lot, his son, his nephew. Abraham and Lot go separate ways. Lot goes to Sodom and Gomorrah, which, Lord willing, we will talk about in the near future. And Abram stays there, and he looks out on all this land. And here's what we read in verse 14 of Genesis 13. The Lord said to Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, westward. In other words, stand on this mountain and look everywhere, every direction. For all the land which you see, to you will I give it and to your seed forever. And I will make your seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall your seed also be numbered. Now we look here and we see that God promises Abram two things. He promises him a land that will eventually we'll see is called the promised land through Scripture. It comes from this passage. This is land that is promised to Abram. The next thing we see is that Abram is promised to have so many descendants that it is impossible for them to be numbered. That's going to be a big deal because we're going to see that Abram's unable to have children in just a little bit. But we see here two promises, that there is going to be a promised land and there is a promised people. And the promised people is innumerable. In other words, there is no way any mankind can ever count them. Now, there is going to be, as we've looked in the Old Testament, there's each one of the little puzzle pieces. Some of the puzzle pieces are shadows of the real thing. Are we, according to Hebrews 11, are we and Abram and everyone else looking for a piece of land in the Middle East? No. Is this promise about a piece of land in the Middle East? Yes, but no. It is a picture, that piece of land in the Middle East that Abram sees is a picture that there is a greater promised land, even greater than us going back to the Garden of Eden. And that is that we are looking for a new heaven and a new earth. What does the book of Revelation talk about? It talks about where we dwell with God in a new land. Sometimes, how many of you have ever heard the song, Beulah Land? Well, Beulah Land, it's talking about the beautiful land that we're going to. We talk about the promised land and all that. For us as Christians, it's not, hey, we get to go to the Middle East. It's we get to go and dwell with God. Okay, what was lost? We lost paradise. We lost the Garden of Eden. We lost the fellowship of God. What good is it to have the most fruitful land the world has ever seen if God is not there? It does no good. What good does it do you if you strike oil on your land and you have not God? You see, the whole purpose of this is to show that Abram is going to bring about, there's a descendant that's going to come to bring about a promised land through Abram. Is that promised land the Middle East? Well, in some respect, there's a physical promise here that is promised to the Jewish people. But what is a picture of? That through Abram, there is going to come about one who is going to usher in God's people into a land of promise, far greater than the land of Canaan. What was the second promise? Is that there was going to be an innumerable number of people that are going to inherit this land. What do we find John seeing in Revelation? A host of people no man can number. He sees people from every tribe, tongue, and nation. But you know what he says? No one can number them. What is the promise here? It's not that Jesus is going to usher in 12 people. You know, I know the Jehovah's Witnesses believe that there's only 144,000 people going to go to heaven. Okay? I can count to 144,000. It'll take me a while, but I can count that high. Most people can count that high. If you get about, you know, 8 years old, you can count that high if you have the stamina. Mm-hmm. Okay? You know what's going to happen? Is the descendant, the seed of the woman, the seed of Abraham, is going to save a number of people that no man can number. I want you to think about that for a minute. Sometimes we have a pessimistic view of our world, that our world is going to hell in a handbasket and that the enemy is winning. And I'm going to submit to you that there are going to be more than 7 trillion people saved. Why? Well, if you count long enough, you can count 7 trillion. There are going to be so many people saved through Jesus Christ that no man can number them. Why? Because that is the promise made to Abraham. Okay, does this mean there's going to be a whole lot of Jews? Yes, that means there's going to be a whole lot of Jews. Does it mean there's going to be a whole lot of Arabs through Ishmael? Yes. But is this really about a little piece of land and the Jews? No, it's about more than that. It is about this, yes. But it's about something far greater, and that is a promised land that the descendant is going to, the seed of the woman, that Jesus Christ is going to bring in and save an innumerable number of people. They're going to be ushered into God's presence in a new heaven and a new earth and the ultimate promised land. Again, this is a picture of the reality. This is a shadow of the real thing to come. Now let's look, and what happens next is Lot is living near Sodom and Gomorrah. There is a huge war, and Lot and his whole family are captured along with all the people who live in Sodom and Gomorrah. Abram gets his soldiers together and goes and fights and defeats these kings. He defeats them, he delivers Lot, he delivers everyone, he gets all of the possessions, from Sodom, Gomorrah, everywhere else, all of the people, and he's now coming back to take these people back home. Here we're going to see something that looks like very insignificant, but if you're familiar with the book of Hebrews, you'll see this is extremely significant. Here in Genesis 14, beginning in verse 18. This is Abram coming back with all of the people from Sodom and Gomorrah. He went to deliver Lot and his family. Notice what happens. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered your enemies into your hand." And he, that's Abram, gave him, that's Melchizedek, tithes of all. Now this is very, very important. Okay, we read in the book of Hebrews about why this is so important. I remember several years ago somebody asked me one time, and it's kind of funny to me, he said, "How can Jesus be a high priest if Jesus didn't come from the tribe of Levi?" And I said, "Well, the answer's in the book of Hebrews. Let's turn there." He goes, "All you preachers ever want to talk about is the book of Hebrews. There's a reason we like the book of Hebrews, because it talks about how Jesus is greater than Moses, how Jesus is a priest after the order of Melchizedek." This is extremely important. Why? Because we are looking for a prophet, we are looking for a king, but we are also looking for a priest. Abram here is going to be the one through whom the line comes, who the Messiah is coming through Abram. Yet he meets this king of Salem. The word Salem means peace. He meets this king of peace, who according to Hebrews, and we see here, has no descendants. We have no idea where this man comes from. It is as if he's always existed. We don't know who his mother is, who his father is. We have no idea. This king of peace comes out of nowhere and blesses Abram, and Abram tithes to the king of Salem. Now this should tell us a whole bunch. Who do you give your tithes to? To God. They don't go to man, they go to God. What is this showing us? That the king of Salem here is a picture of a high priest that is greater than Aaron, that is greater than Abram, that is divine. So we are looking for a divine high priest that is far greater than Abram. But he's going to descend from Abram. He's going to be a descendant of Abraham. He's going to be a descendant of Isaac, a descendant of Jacob. Okay, we are looking for that priest. We are looking for the one who can enter into the Holy of Holies and not plead with the blood of some other lamb, but plead with his own blood. Not come washing himself so that he might be cleansed, but comes in with the power of a holy, pure life. This is what it teaches in Hebrews. That our salvation is not brought about by a lamb and a earthly priest that goes and offers a sacrifice on his own behalf and washes himself in the laver and enters into the Holy of Holies. Our salvation is brought about by one who is after the same priesthood of Melchizedek, who is no origin that we know of, the eternal Son of God, who is divine, who is perfect, who is the King of Kings, Lord of Lords, Prince of Peace. And he is the one who is the descendant of Abram, but he is also the one who is Son of God. He's Son of Man, Son of God. So you begin to see that Melchizedek here is a huge picture and representation, and I would even submit to you the reality. I would submit to you that Melchizedek is Jesus Christ. Okay? We don't know that because the Bible didn't come out and say that, but I would submit to you that the angel that wrestles with Jacob is Jesus Christ. Because he says, you can't see my face and live. You say, well, but Jesus wasn't born yet. No, but Jesus already existed. Jesus is the pre-existent, eternal Son of God. So we see here, and this is very important, we're looking, and if you notice what's happening here, you almost need like a huge marker board to write down all the promises. Because, okay, we're looking for the seed of the woman, and that, you look at the seed of the woman, what we see, there's a whole bunch of stuff, okay? That means it's got Adam's nature, but doesn't have Adam's nature, okay? All of these things. Born of a virgin, all of these things. And then you go, wait a minute, okay. Well, he's going to be like the ark. All those who are in him are kept safe by the hand of God. And that's by grace. It's by faith. All of these things. But, you know, you keep going through. By the end of the Old Testament, we're looking at things in a little bit more detail. But if you just take wooden, blank, you know, behold, the virgin shall conceive, there are over 1,000 prophecies concerning the Messiah. And what you find in the New Testament? Jesus Christ fulfills every single one of them. Every single one of them. So if you did what Jesus said to do, we looked in John 5, if you went back and read the Old Testament, you know what you should find? You should find Jesus in every single story. Because he is there. What is the big picture? The big picture is you take Melchizedek, and you take Abram, and you take Sodom and Gomorrah, and you take Noah, and you take Shem, and you take Cain and Abel and all of this. And then when you take all the puzzle pieces and you put them together and you zoom out, what do you have? Jesus. That's the picture. Everything. Remember when we talked about masculinity, femininity, being fruitful, multiplying, dominion, God's glory. What was every bit of that? Every puzzle piece, when you look at masculinity, when you zoom out, what is a picture of? Jesus Christ. Even femininity, when you zoom out, what is a picture of? What does 1 Corinthians 11 teach us? That God the Father is head, God the Son submits to his head, and even so, the man is the head of the woman, and as Christ submitted to his head, so the woman submits to her head. Even femininity is a picture of Jesus Christ. So if you look at the big picture, what are you looking at? Jesus. David and Goliath is about Jesus. Melchizedek, Jesus. Abram getting in a fight and killing all these kings and delivering these people? It's about Jesus. Why? Because we're looking for a greater warrior and a greater deliverer than Abram. That when we have been captured and enslaved by sin, we are looking for someone greater than Abram to come and deliver us. Now this is going to keep going here. Okay? Let's go on and look here at chapter 15. And we're going to look here with the covenant made with Abram. Chapter 15, beginning in verse 1. After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. And Abram said, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus? And Abram said, Behold, to me you have given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, This shall not be your heir, but he that shall come forth out of your own bowels shall be your heir. And he brought him forth abroad and said, Look now toward heaven, and tell the stars if you be able to number them. And he said unto him, so shall your seed be. And he believed in the Lord, and he counted it to him for righteousness. Abram is here talking with God. God says, Abraham, don't be afraid. I'm your shield and I'm your reward. And Abram goes, okay, Lord, I trust you. I believe you've got a little problem here. You said that in me, all the families of the earth will be blessed. In other words, I'm going to be the one that one of my descendants is going to be the Messiah. One little problem. I don't have any descendants. I have no children. Now, at this point in time, when a servant had a child, that would be considered part of your household. So he speaks of Eliezer. He's got, I got Eliezer. He's part of my household. Maybe that's who you're talking about. Maybe that's who the descendant's going to be. And God says to Abram, no, your physical descendant, out of your own bowels. Okay, I love King James, out of your bowels. Okay, that's who the Messiah is going to be. And he takes him, go outside, count the stars. Okay, now we live in the country out here, and you can see a lot of stars. You go in the city, you can't see very many. But even out here, you can't see very many. If you go out to like Montana, Wyoming, and wait till there is no moon, there are trillions of stars that are visible. Again, can you count the dust of the earth? Can you count the number of grains on the seashore? Count the stars, Abram. There are no street lights where Abram's at. Okay? There's no street lights. There are no city lights. Okay, this is as dark gets. And there's stars everywhere. Have you all ever been where you can see the Milky Way very clearly? Have you all ever seen that? Okay, that is absolutely mind-boggling. Because it looks like a cloud running the whole length of the sky. And it's not. It's trillions of stars. But it's not. Some of those stars are actually galaxies filled with stars. Again, what was the promise? All the families of the earth will be blessed. There will be a number of people that no man can number. So for us as God's people, and this is just kind of a practical application, are we looking for one or two people to be saved? We're looking for trillions. And one of the reasons we don't see trillions is because we're looking for one or two. It's because of our unbelief. But here, Abram is told, I want you to think here, let's do some math here. Abram, I can't remember exactly how old he is now. I think he's about 85 at this point in time. And that would make his wife around 70-ish. Okay? And I should have looked up the numbers beforehand. But he's about 85 years old. His wife's about 70. Now, let's do some math here. How old is it when women typically stop being able to have children? 45? 50? 55? 60? 65? Okay. Now, I know this is a time when ages and people are living longer, so we give some benefit there. But we read in Hebrews 11 that Abraham was as good as dead. Okay, that's one of those encouraging phrases. I know you're like 100 years old, Abraham, but you're as good as dead. In other words, everyone knew. Okay, when we talk about women having children, okay, you know, women, their peak years of having children are about 16 to 30. And after 30, it just kind of goes downhill. This woman's well after 30. Well after 30. And God says, you are going to have so many children, you will be unable to count them. Now, again, let's do some math here. If Sarah gets pregnant this moment, it's going to be 9 months till she has another baby, or till she has a baby. Then it's going to be a couple more months before she could have another one. So you're talking, how on earth is Abram going to have millions and millions and millions of babies? He can't even have one. He can't. Well, what is the promise? Well, the promise here is to walk by faith, not by sight. And this is, again, one of those things you can kind of walk right on the chalkboard. What is it that makes Abram acceptable before God? What does it say? He believed the Lord. This is before circumcision. This is before the Ten Commandments. This is before the animal sacrifices in Leviticus. This is before the dietary laws. This is before every single bit of it. This is before every single bit of it. How is a man accepted before God? By faith and faith alone. That is it. Where is Abraham's faith in? The promise of a deliverer. How are people saved before the coming of Christ? This is a question that I ask in my kids' catechism. You know what the answer is? They believed in the Savior to come. Abram here, what is his faith placed in? That God is going to provide himself a lamb. We're going to see that later in Abram, aren't we? Abraham, take your son, your only son, whom you love. Go sacrifice him in the place where I tell you of. What does he say? My son, God will provide a lamb. What is the faith? The faith is that God will provide a deliverer. That's his faith. So salvation, then, has always been faith in the deliverer. Faith in the seed of the woman. Taking God at his word. Faith is believing what is humanly impossible. We're going to talk about that later on today. We're talking about feeding the 5,000. Faith is believing what you will never see. Have you ever thought about this about salvation? I know many of y'all, most of y'all in here are believers. Have you ever thought about the insanity of salvation? You are expected to believe in a God you have never seen, of a virgin whom you have never seen, giving birth to a child you've never seen, in a place you've never seen, who lived a life you've never seen, who died on a cross you've never seen, was buried in a tomb you've never seen, and rose again from the dead, and you haven't seen any of it. And he's now King of Kings and Lord of Lords in a heaven you've never seen, on a throne you've never seen. How do you accept it then? By faith. God said it, and that's it. If God said it, it will be so. You see, Abram does not live in the realm of human possibilities. Let me give you something that will help you in your walk with the Lord. There is no such thing as the supernatural. Don't you think about that for a minute. There is no such thing as the supernatural. We live in a natural world, and then there's a supernatural. And the supernatural is when God comes in and undoes the natural world. Correct? That's the way we view it. But the Bible portrays a world where God is in everything. And God does whatever he wants to. And God is not subservient to the laws of nature. The laws of nature are subservient to their lawgiver. So it is only natural for when Jesus says, Lazarus, come forth, it is only natural for him to come forth because he is under the law of God, not the law of nature. That there is no supernatural. If Jesus says, get up and walk, it is not supernatural for creation to be submissive to its creator. That's just natural. But what we have done is we have created this world where God says he's going to give you a child, and you go, God, that's impossible. What do you mean it's impossible? But creation is subservient to the creator. That is natural. That is the way it is. So Abram just says, okay, God says it, that's true. He believes God. So salvation we see here in the story of Abram is found in what? Is it found in being a physical descendant of Abram? No. What did John say? He said that God is able to raise up of these stones children to Abram. Jesus said the exact same thing. Is salvation being found in being born a Jew? No. Nicodemus was born a Jew, and Jesus told him, you have to be born again. Salvation is not found through physical descendants. Okay? This is before the law. So salvation cannot be through keeping the law. This is before circumcision. So salvation cannot be through circumcision. This is before baptism. This is before church. This is before church membership. This is before everything. What is it? Salvation, then, is faith in the Messiah. Faith in the Christ. It is belief in the promised one. It is that's where Abraham is saved. Okay? And now, something else to notice here that's very important. If you look, the word that we've been using over and over again, and it continues here, is the word seed is singular. It is always singular. If you look in all of God's interactions with Abraham, He says, you will have thousands and thousands of children, so shall your child be. To put it in our English. He's always plural, 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 seed, singular. Plural, 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 seed, singular. Every bit of it is through seed, singular. Why? Because the promise is not to all those who can trace their lineage back to Abram. The promise is all those who can trace their nature back to Christ. The promise is not found in Abram. It's found in the seed, singular. The one descendant. That's why after Abram has two children. In fact, Abram has a whole lot more than two children. I think he has another five. Is that what he has? Another five kids? Maybe another seven. He ends up having like six or seven sons. But you know what? It's not Isaac even. Isaac's got two. But you know what? It's not either one of them. It goes to Jacob. He's got 12. It's not one of them. It goes down and down and down. Because we are not looking for Reuben or Esau or Ishmael. We're not even looking for Isaac or Jacob or Judah. We're looking for one. That's why you'll find in the New Testament, you'll find the disciples and people saying, is this the one? Is this the one? Because for us, there is only one man. There's only one mediator. And that promise to Abram is not for all of his physical descendants. That means all the promises of God are found in the seed of Abraham, which is Jesus Christ. And all those who by faith, we read later on in the New Testament, that the descendants of Abraham are those who, like Abraham, believe in the Messiah to come. That it's not the physical descendants of Abraham that are the chosen ones, that it's all those who by faith become the children of Abraham by faith. That he is the father of faith. Abraham is the father of faith. And to be blessed like Abraham is blessed is to believe God. That is how it is counted righteousness. It's faith in the singular seed to come, the Messiah. So we'll end here. Abraham now receives a covenant. We're going to see later on about Ishmael. We'll look at circumcision, Sodom and Gomorrah, all that, Lord willing, the weeks to come. But what we're going to look at today is we're going to close with the covenant that God makes with Abram. We looked at the covenant that God made with Noah, that he would not destroy the earth with the flood. But now here in Genesis 15, beginning in verse 18, God makes a blood covenant. We talked about marriage a little bit in the beginning of Genesis, and we talked about marriage being a blood covenant a little bit. But what happens here is a little grotesque, and that is that Abram takes a whole bunch of animals and rips them in half. He rips them in half, and he lays each part of it. He takes a goat, and he rips the goat in half. And lays one half of the goat on one side, one half on the other. He does this with several animals. And then God comes down and walks between the two animals. Now, this is a blood covenant. What God is saying, if I do not keep my covenant, you can rip me in half like these animals. Okay? Now, again, that goes back to marriage. Marriage is a blood covenant. And what you are saying before God is, if I don't keep my covenant, you can rip me in half. Again, we have to teach our children this because we have to take marriage seriously. Because marriage is a serious covenant, like the covenant God makes with Abram. Okay? So you think of the covenant God makes with Abram. One, God can't lie. So we know this is going to happen. But two, God makes a blood covenant saying that even if he did lie, you could go and rip him in half. Okay? Now, obviously, you can't rip him in half. And it's obviously because you won't need to because he'll keep his word. So here in verse 18, what do we have? The same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, and this is the conclusion of everything we looked at this morning, unto your seed, is that singular or plural? Singular. Unto your seed have I given this land. So this is the promised land. We have singular seed. We have promised land. From the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadamites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaims, the Amorites, and the Canaanites, remember that, the Girgashites and the Jebusites. He has given to them through the seed, the promised one, there is going to come a promised land. For all those who are the descendants of Abram, are the descendants physical, or are the descendants those who believe in the Messiah to come. So we see the gospel here. But notice what it says here at the end. The Canaanites dwell in the land. What did we look at last week? Before we looked at the Tower of Babel, what did we look at? We looked at Ham's sin with Noah. And Noah cursed the Canaanites. So we're looking here at the Canaanites. And what you're going to see from this point forward is you're going to see the two lines run through Scripture. The line of the flesh, Canaanites. You're going to see the line of the spirit, Israel. It's a picture for us. Because remember, when they get into the promised land, they're told to wipe out the Canaanites. What is that for us? Does that mean, you know, we go to Canada and wipe out the Canadians? No. That means we don't live by flesh and we destroy all hope in the flesh. They're told not to intermarry. What are we told in 1 Corinthians? Don't be unequally yoked. Why? Because what union does Christ have with Belial? Okay, this is a picture of the Christian life and the struggle you're going to see between the spirit and the flesh when the children of Israel in the book of Judges goes in, in the book of Joshua and the book of Judges, and it goes all the way through. What are you going to find in Solomon's life, David's life, Saul's life? What is their constant struggle with? You're going to find the struggle between the Canaanites, which is the Philistines and all those who dwell there, and you're going to find the struggle with the Israelites, which is a picture of the lifelong struggle that we have between the flesh and the spirit. But what do you find in all of this? You find that they can't subdue the land until a king like David comes. And what does a king like David do? He gains the whole promised land. So what are we looking for? Again, a king that's greater than David, that brings a deliverance greater than David. So that's very important to set the stage for us, because remember, when is Genesis written? It's written to the children of Israel shortly before they cross the Jordan and go fight the Canaanites. So this is, again, saying this is land promised to you, but obviously we are looking for a greater land through a greater deliverer and a greater Messiah. All right, any comments or questions on all this? I know we went over a lot today, but don't everybody speak at once? Question?
So was Melchizedek, he really was a king, an actual character, that, and Salem, I'm taking, was like Jerusalem?
We do not know, per se, whether this was a literal physical king who was a picture of the Messiah, or whether this was literally Jesus as King of Kings. The word Salem means peace. So we do not know if Salem was a city called Peace, because that's what Jerusalem is, City of Peace,
right,
or if Salem was the title of Jesus Christ, who is King of Kings, Prince of Peace. I would tend to say this was probably Jesus Christ, and not a what we would consider literal king of a literal place called Salem. I would say that this is Jesus Christ, just as we're going to see when it comes to Genesis 18, destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, that three people come to visit Abram, one of whom is God. And he talks with one of the visitors, and it's very clear he's talking with God. I would say that the king of Salem was the term is pre-incarnate, or before he became flesh, appearance of Jesus Christ. There are some theologians who would say, no, Salem was a literal place, and this king was a picture. To me, I think either way it's a picture, but I would say it's probably a reality that it was Jesus Christ. Any other comments, thoughts? All righty. Well, let's close in prayer. Bob, can you pray for us?